So, particularly exciting to be approaching this show from as a producing organization. It's the first time Seattle Shakespeare Company has produced Titus Andronicus. It's taken us 25 years to get to this play. And so it's a long-waiting opportunity to really discover the sort of unexpected joy and pleasure of this play. And it truly is, especially because, you know, I mean, not only will David talk about the themes and the stories, the theme and the story and the deep humanity that's within all of this carnage, but for us as, artists, you know, not to say that, you know, Seattle Shakespeare Company is the only Shakespeare game in town, but this is just not a really often done play. And so I bet for, certainly for me, and I'm expecting for a lot of you, it's one of the first times I bet you've worked on this play. So how often do you get the chance to first do a Shakespeare play, especially when you're as advanced in your career as I am, to finally get to tackle a piece and discover it for the first time? So I'm really excited about it as an actor, as a producer. How many here have done Titus Andronicus before? We got a producer and a dramaturg, and that's it. So and a stage manager. So for the rest of us, it's like a brand new Shakespeare play. How cool is that? And to helm us as we navigate these turgid waters of this play, I turn to my good friend David Quicksall, who this particular play, I think, having known him for a while and having experienced some of the giddy glee with which he has been planning this play, I know that it was a right choice. It fits into a lot of some of this really great wheelhouse strengths for Dave. Having directed Coriolanus for us, so he knows how to tackle these sort of obscure, complex Roman plays. Having seen his work in some of the book side of things with Frankenstein and Dracula, he loves the horror side of things as well. And I think that this play marries those two things in a very unique way and has brought out both the Shakespeare and the horror side of Dave in some really fun and inventive, but I also think respectful and truthful ways. So it's my pleasure to now turn over the rest of the rehearsal time to Dave Quicksall and his team.
I also like comedy. thanks, George. It's funny, I have been an actor in this play before. My introduction to this play was as an audience member when I was a student at UC Santa Cruz, and Shakespeare Santa Cruz did it in the forest at night. And so that's when I saw it, and I just gleefully fell in love with this play as an audience member, experiencing it in the kind of horrific setting of the Redwood Forest at night. It was pretty great. But what the company did was they allowed, because I was in the other Roman part of the season, so I was acting in Julius Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra, and the other company was outside doing Comedy of Errors and Titus Andronicus. So you can imagine which group was having the better time. Those guys were having so much fun. But they allowed us who were in the other cast to come in and play the clown. The clown's not in our production. I cut him out, but we got to kind of come on. He has like two lines, and then he gets killed. And so that was my... So I have acted in that role for very briefly. So I came on, and I ogled Tamara, and then Saturninus says, go hang him. And it's like, wait. I was really excited to get a chance to explore this play from a director perspective and from a true appreciator of Shakespeare's work. And it's very interesting because as a director, it seems like I'm nibbling from the extreme ends of the canon. So I've directed The Tempest and Coriolanus, and then I've directed Two Gentlemen of Verona, and now Titus Andronicus. So I kind of am coming at his work this way. So I've worked at stuff very intimately at the most mature end of his career as a writer, and now looking at his very young upstart crow, what I like to think of as Quentin Tarantino-esque part of his career. And I've been, for this particular production, I was really drawn to the aspect of Titus Andronicus was a very popular play in Shakespeare's time, and it has so many recorded performances of it, more so than many of his other plays. It had many quartos published, which were published for people to read. Shakespeare didn't see any of that money, of course, because there were no copyright laws and all of that. But so it was also a very popular piece to be read. And it also had a popular ballad made from it. And so it was a really popular play. I like to think of Shakespeare coming. He shows up in London. He's kind of a young guy. He writes, you know, these like Henry VI plays. And, you know, he writes Two Gentlemen of Verona. And but he's looking around, and it's like, what is cramming the people into the theater? What is the big box office sell? And there were plays like Marlowe's The Jew of Malta. And, you know, and The Jew of Malta has a guy who pimps his own daughter. That's one thing he does. He poisons a convent full of nuns. That's another thing he does. I mean, really great villain, you know. And one of the other popular plays was Thomas Kidd's The Spanish Tragedy, which follows the kind of tragedy of a character named Jeronimo, whose son is killed by some noblemen, and he spends the entire play trying to wreak his revenge. And he finally gets to it at the end, and at the very end, instead of telling everybody why he did it, he bites out his own tongue and then kills himself. So these were two very, very popular plays when Shakespeare sat down to write Titus Andronicus. And I like to think that he sat down saying, you know what, I'm watching these revenge tragedies, I can do that. Not only that, is that I will do it in a way that no one's ever done it before. That tragedy has like 5 dead bodies on stage. I'm going to have 14. You know, that guy chews out his own tongue. Well, I'll have a woman get ravished, and they'll cut her hands off and cut her tongue out. And you know what else I'll do is I'll have a mother eat her own children. I mean, you know, it just doesn't get any more kind of demented than that. However, it was very popular. And so I started, my very early kernel was violence as entertainment. And if you think about it, it hasn't changed. You can open up the newspaper and look at any movie. I mean, I guarantee there's going to be movies out there right now. You know, and I don't care if it's a movie based on a Marvel comic book. It's still extremely violent. Lots of explosions. Lots of people dying. Some movies have very horrific graphic deaths. Some don't. Sex, violence, it's all over the media. It's all on the television. So it's something that is really a part of our life. It's a commodity that is consumed. And it hasn't changed since the Greeks. You know, and I just think, I can't answer from a Freudian level or from a psychologist kind of level of why. All I know is that when I see a nice, bloody, action-packed film, sometimes I really like them, you know. And sometimes I remember going to see, what was that movie, The Running Man? Bad Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. And a friend of mine I went to school with, who is now actually the creator and writer and producer of the Spartacus series, he's a buddy who went to school with another guy who gleefully loved violence. I mean, you just have to watch those Spartacus things and you can see it's all over the place. Anyway, I'll just never forget sitting next to him during The Running Man, and there's a scene at the very beginning where these guys have these collars, and if they run past a certain barrier, their head blows up. And I just remember him just cackling away. It was just, oh, that guy's head, it looked so real. It was like great, you know. And anyway, here we are, Titus Andronicus. Don't have any exploding heads, but you know. I say all this because there's a certain relish, there's a certain joy, maybe. There's a certain value to stories that are filled with bad people doing bad things to people. And it's all over the place. And so that's kind of where I started, was this idea of popular entertainment and how violence and kind of that stuff is really popular. And it sells, you know, it sells. And so, but of course, there's other things going on as well. So one of the things that I started thinking about was, you know, this idea that we've got violence and sex and film, and one of the things that I came back to was that idea of how it used to be part of the entertainment in the 70s back when you used to go to the drive-in movies. You know, these kind of slasher films at drive-in movies, and you can see any number of those, some of them really bad films from the 70s. One that comes up to mind is The Last House on the Left, which is this story about these, basically a home invasion, and the whole movie is just this horrific thing that happens, and that's very popular, a Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, you can think of all kinds of movies that did very, very well. And that was kind of a kickoff place for me. And as I started talking with Carol and Jocelyn and Nathan Wade and Andy Smith, the amazing design team that we have for this show, I was really talking about that kind of, I was calling it a kind of grindhouse aesthetic, is this idea of like, not that we're creating a drive-in movie, but there's this idea of like it's embracing an environment and a world where such horrific things can happen. And I think if we give the audience that permission, I believe, it gives them a place to start from, whereas all of these things that happen and unfold in this play makes it of a world that they can handle. Because I think this play, from an audience perspective, is something you have to cope with. You have to cope with being shown a woman who has been raped, her hands cut off, and her tongue cut out. You have to cope with that. So how do you do that? And I think one of the ways of doing that is creating this environment where such things are not only expected, but in some ways kind of commonplace almost. And it's a violent world. It's a revengeful world. And it's a world that is filled with kind of tit for tat, although I would argue that the tat is far more extreme than that part was. Not a good turn of phrase. There's something about the revenge tragedy as well that kind of brings to question is, what do you get? What do you get when you follow this rabbit hole of vengeance to its kind of end point? And you know, I would argue that Shakespeare did not leave the revenge tragedy with Titus Andronicus. You know, he kind of started there, but then look where he went with the genre. He went to Hamlet, which is a revenge tragedy, where you have the protagonist who agonizes through the whole play about whether he should do it or not. And then you could also look, you could even look at some of his later plays like The Tempest, which, when you think about it, Prospero, he has all of his enemies there. He wants to have revenge. But what does he do? He finds that the greater grace is to forgive. So you start off with this kind of horrific, horrific play about revenge. And then you kind of go into a place where you kind of, the revenge tragedy aspect's on the outside. So what you do is you go on an internal journey to this young man who is agonizing not only about the revenge that he has to take, but also his place in the universe. And then you go to The Tempest, which is this kind of magical place where forgiveness becomes the quality that sets Prospero free. And I think that part of this play is you're left at the end with this massive body count at the end, and it's like, what for? You know, Rome at this time, in Shakespeare's play here of Titus Andronicus, is kind of an inventive Rome. It's got aspects of early Republic, like in Coriolanus. It's got aspects of late Republic, like in Julius Caesar. And then it has aspects of late Empire. So it's, you know, it spans a huge, centuries and centuries of Roman history are kind of easily juggled around by Shakespeare. I don't think he really cared, you know, it's a theatrical Rome. It's a revenge tragedy Rome. It's kind of its own reality. And I think that also helps us with the idea of design-wise of kind of this grindhouse aesthetic. Things are kind of a little dirty. Things are kind of, it has a contemporary feel to it. Much like when we did Coriolanus earlier, it's got remnants of modernity, but also some touches of kind of Romanesque motifs. And the set itself has also got touches of kind of what we would think of as classic Roman, but also touches of modernity. And so I'm really playing fast and easy with time and place with this play, which is what Shakespeare did. I read in all of my kind of jostling about with different things I've been reading, I came across this one phrase which I thought was really, really great, which was, and it was actually a book about Elizabethan stage directions and conventions. That's what this book was about, and really fascinating reading. And one of the things it mentioned was that as modern audiences, we get really caught up in the realism of where we are. You know, it's like the setting. You know, we're really caught up in kind of the reality of, like, where are we right now? You know, that kind of thing. And this particular writer is arguing that the Elizabethans didn't care about that. Setting sometimes was kind of, it didn't matter. What mattered was the action on stage. And so that's why so many times you'll have just the characters say where they are. Okay, that's where we are. We can move on. And so this kind of, he talked about that we've lost this sense of the flexibility of the Elizabethan stage. And then he also called it the kind of chameleon stage, which I thought was really interesting. This idea that the stage is always morphing and changing color, changing aspects at will. I mean, you can think of a really kind of stage direction, or not even a stage direction, it's dialogue in Julius Caesar, where you have all the guys ready to kill Caesar, and they're approached by some people on the street, and Cassius says something like, urge your petition in the street, come to the Capitol, and then boom, they're in the Capitol. So, you know, Shakespeare, you know, often said he would have written for film if he was alive today, but he does these really great jump cuts where the reality of the setting changes as the scene changes. And there was also this comment made, I've got to find a place where this happens, is that sometimes the scene comes to the action. So the action starts, you don't necessarily know where you're at, and then suddenly the scene reveals where you are. And so this idea that the scene comes to the action, I thought was kind of interesting. Anyway, so this idea of drive-in movie, film, a kind of modern aesthetic, but also this idea of a place that can be, that can morph and change, and our setting can change really fluidly, which is also very cinematic and film-like. And then working with Carol, we kind of came up with this idea, and I'll just give it to you in a second here. This idea that there's kind of some ways to go with the Rome that we're setting up, and there's something about this Rome that feels, you know, kind of decadent and a little over the top. I mean, the play's a little over the top, just a little bit. There's something decadent about this Rome, something a bit over the top, something a bit extreme and lavish, and, you know, it's filled with kind of intrigue and sex and all kinds of stuff. And then you have what I like to call the austerity of the Andronicus house. You know, there's something kind of this militaristic family. You know, they're a family of soldiers. Titus has 25 sons and one daughter. We start off the play, 20 of his sons are dead from war. We don't get to see them all die. They're already dead. So maybe the count, body count's 34. It's not 14. We start off with 20 dead bodies. I never thought about that. So there's this kind of, there's the house of Saturninus, the emperor, if you want to think of it, the house, the palace, the royal court. And then there's the house of Andronicus. And it really is, you know, George was talking about the kind of layers to this story. It really is, in some regards, a story about two families, two households alike in dignity. No. There's a certain kind of interesting connection in some ways with Romeo and Juliet, where, you know, you do have these kind of two warring families. You know, you have the family of, you think of it, the family of Tamora, who is now allied with the emperor of Rome, against the family of Andronicus. And one of the classic motifs of revenge tragedy is that the person who is seeking revenge is always in a position of lesser power. He's in a position of weakness, or most of the time, political power. Is that he is trying to get revenge against a king or a king's son. And if you think about Hamlet, that's totally what it is, against Hamlet against Claudius. Or if you look at any number of, like, Hieronymo in the Spanish tragedy, he's just a functionary in the court, and he's trying to wreak his revenge against the king's son. So there's this idea of a disparity in power. And so whether the Elizabethans as an audience were really drawn to that idea of watching people who were not in power help the people who were in power have their comeuppance. You know, I'm sure that that was a driving force of what made it a popular story. I mean, you can think of any number of movies where you have a person who has, like, been wronged, and the people who did the wrong are in powerful positions, are in politically powerful positions, or they're rich or whatever, and the whole movie is about them getting their revenge or their, you know, so that the people who are on top get their comeuppance. The thing is, to end of Titus Andronicus, and I think this is something that Shakespeare is pointing out to us, is that what everyone has a come up. I mean, everyone dies, you know, and you're left with this carnage on stage, and you're left with an up-and-coming emperor, or the guy who basically crowns himself as emperor, who, through the course of the play, has demonstrated that he's not necessarily such a nice guy either, you know. So you're left with the question of, well, where does all this violence and revenge lead us? So that idea of the kind of disparity between the Andronicus house and the emperor's court was one of the kickoff points for ideas of set. And so, do you want to talk a little bit, Carol?
Sure. Yeah.
This is Carol, everybody, our wonderful set designer.
So, thanks for all of that. So the first, when Dave and I first started talking, we were emailing back and forth to get an appointment to sit down and start talking about this, and he wrote to me and said, if you get a chance, go see Pompeii at the Pacific Science Center. It's closing this weekend, I think. So before we had talked at all, I ran over there. I don't know if many of you saw that, but I ran over and saw the exhibit, and I came out with, you know, definitely some ideas about things, but I was also thinking, oh, he's kind of going realism, I guess. He's kind of doing this, you know, we're going to do Rome, and I sort of started, you know, maybe we're emphasizing the family, or I don't know. I started thinking about all these things, but there were things that were interesting to me. Stone and the deep reds, there was a lot of amber light and beautiful intricate pieces and lots of reds and this thing called the Compluvian was really interesting to me, which was this hole in the ceiling held up by columns that you see the sky through that hole and it's open so that water drains down into the Impluvian, which is like a pool. I thought that was really interesting. So then we met and the first thing he said to me was, thanks, slasher movies. So that's kind of where it started. I was like, oh, okay. So it's kind of the Roman, a Roman story through Grindhouse film. So some of those things stayed with me. That arch, upstage arch that's columns, traditional columns with this piece of sky that you see that's kind of the only thing that's kind of soft and blue and out there through this kind of deeper red, harder playing space. One of the things that David talked about early on was shadows, so this could also be a place to project shadows upstage. There was a part in that exhibit, if you've seen it, that was like the X-rated or the R-rated part of the exhibit where if you didn't want your children to see that part, you could shoo them aside.
So, and of course, all the kids wanted to see it.
Yeah. The whole thing was kind of absurd, really. But you go into this area with the dark lighting and lots of red velvet drape, and I think that kind of stuck with me that we're showing this kind of R-rated or X-rated part. So the red velvet drape came into it there. An area for tombs or these half-round arches, but using those as a playing space. The idea of decadence and opulence, platforms are almost like beds that you could lay all over, and cushions and chandelier and more. This is just a board with a variety of pictures of things that were interesting to me. So kind of that the red velvet, and then all of it is kind of in this empty black space, almost like a movie set. The two big columns that are on, everybody knows about, that are out there on the Seattle Shakes stage. I didn't use those to be columns, but left them black and put these kind of stone stairs up around them. One of the things that David talked about is two podiums for speeches and other things. So those things kind of circle the columns. There's movable pieces, and David's so incredible at playing with sets. It's fun to watch him play, moving things around. So I think that's kind of the general idea. Lots of deep red stone, the sky kind of behind, a little bit of bare trees off to the side to just kind of evoke that sense of outdoor
mayhem.
Yeah, there's a long piece. It can be used in all different ways. It can be used as a bench or a low table. It can be raised up to be a taller table. Possibly the, on that last scene, using a white tablecloth so that, because the floor is red, so that the blood really shows up on the white on top of the red. I think that kind of... Then there would be more details than what is in the model right now in terms of bits and pieces of things. And there's a magazine up there, too, if you're interested in a look at more of the color. There are just a number of things in that old magazine that and I have it all marked, so if you're interested in color ideas. I think that's kind of it.
Oh, you know, one of the other aspects that... the set has is a kind of a way to, you know, I think of it as kind of softening up the audience.
Oh, right, right.
Preparing them in some regard. As the audience is coming in, we will actually have a loop of trailers for upcoming attractions playing on a screen. And this screen are these two panels that are reversible. And when the audience comes in, they're actually, they kind of look a bit like a movie screen. Just imagine these a lot bigger than this. And and there will be literally trailers playing. And I'm working with MJ Siever, who's a local actor and filmmaker, and we've already videotaped these trailers, and they're now in what I guess you call post-production. And just to give you a little taste of what one of them is it's all based on these stories that have been around for a long time of people doing bad things to each other. So the first one is like, you know, an upcoming production is Horror in the House of Atreus. And whether you know what the House of Atreus is actually the house of Agamemnon and Menelaus. And when Agamemnon came back from the Trojan War, Clytemnestra took him to his bathtub and then chopped him up with an axe. So I like to think of Horror in the House of Atreus as the very first shower scene. So it's kind of a takeoff of Psycho. And so we have Clytemnestra approaching a shower with an axe. She opens it up, and there's Agamemnon going, "No!" And then she kills him. So I just made that decision for Seattle Shakes that they will be...
it'll be interesting to see if people go, "When's that going to happen?"
So it, for me, it, again, it kind of sets up an environment. It sets up a couple of things for me. It sets up violence, but it also sets up a sense of relish and of kind of I keep coming back to relish. This idea of telling these stories with a certain flair, and I think embracing a story like this, and embracing all of its elements, embracing its violence, embracing its horror, embracing its love, because as I think at the heart of this play, you have a father who kind of discovers his daughter for the first time after they've both been mutilated. I say that and laugh, but I think it's extremely... There's something really interesting that happens to Titus when all of these terrible things happen to him. And he says some of the most tenderest things he's ever said to his daughter, you know, after all of these things have happened. And then I also like to say that we see Titus kill two of his children. He kills his the first child he kills at the very beginning, he kills his son out of anger and wrath. And he kills his daughter at the end out of love. As twisted as that sounds, that's kind of the journey this play goes on. I mean, there's a certain kind of element to the Andronicus family at the center of the play that gets to a place that really transcends the form. And the form itself is violent. It's a violent world, this Rome. It's a treacherous world. But Rome was that way. I mean, we also have to think that Rome, when you think about Rome, it was, towards the early empire, we started to have, certainly had Christianity come into Rome late, but it's a pagan world. It's not a Christian world. And the Elizabethans, of course, were a Christian society. And they also had to deal with this idea of, you know, you have things in the Bible that says, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, right? Revenge belongs in the hands of God, and yet in the Old Testament you have an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You have this kind of contradiction in the Bible itself, you know. So I think that idea also from a moral and an ethical place is also an interesting place that this play goes, is the morality of revenge, the morality of taking revenge into your own hands and away from God, who it belongs to, which was an Elizabethan idea, not a Roman idea. So I think that's also a very interesting thing to play with, is that idea of what is too far as revenge goes. I think this play goes a little far. And so, Jocelyn, you should have.
I'll pass around the originals, but you can look at these later. There's some more images up as well and some color added. But I'll start off with our Roman militia. And they're going to start off much more sleek and put together, and you'll see that very Roman aspect come in through the cape and through the helmet. We will also mask everybody in the Roman militia with these masks here. We're going to kind of disguise our militia a little bit, because a lot of people are going to die right at the beginning and then come back.
I always hate that in the honest way. Wait, that guy was on here like 10 minutes ago and he was that guy.
Our goth militia will be much more hobnob, kind of put together, more green camo type look. We'll probably use the ghillie suit tops, which are scraggly kind of wig-like things to cover up, and we'll also use face paints and stuff like that to disguise our goth militia. Saturninus and kind of our rulers are going to be in more of a narrow cut collared coat. So this is much more of an Asian type of coat cut, but it also harkens back to kind of older styles as well. And they'll stay kind of in like silvers and grays, and then we'll use Roman draperies to kind of take us back to that Roman-esque feel. Titus, for much of the play, is going to stay in like a tunic or kurta, very lounge look, very casual, dressed down compared to some of the others. And also his sons will kind of stick around in this area once they're done with war. Lavinia will start out very sweet. We'll see a little more of her skin, but she'll have a slightly longer cut dress than this is here. And then we'll see her. She'll have two dresses. She'll go hunting in, and then she'll get raped. And one dress will be rigged to kind of rip on stage. And then she'll quick change into a very bloodied, very distressed version of a rape dress. And then after she's raped, she's going to cover herself all up. And her hands are going to be covered in long cloth, so your hands will be free to move under this long piece of drapery. But I also discussed possibly putting you in a hood, so really covering you up, and all we really see is your face, so we'll play around with that. Bassianus is going to be similar to Saturninus. He'll be very sleek, in a much more slim fit coat, kind of that we see, like, you know, Asian kids of today, they wear those sleek, kind of stylish coats, basically like that. And then you'll be much more casual when you go hunting.
Your stabbing outfit.
Here's some of the ideals of those coats. So this is stuff Saturninus will wear. He'll wear these much more kind of stylish jackets. Be slim fit. It's going to be super hip. Aaron will start out the show very, very dressed down and raggedy. There's discussion of him being tied up in a bag at one point at the very beginning. So you'll be skin showing, ragged cape, probably chained up right as we see you. And then you'll move into more of a servant look, but you will gain a coat later on that Tamara gives you. So this is kind of a look Aaron will stick in. Then Chiron and Demetrius, after they move out of their goth militia, they'll move into much more of a sleek, hip Asian kind of feel that we see today. So skinny pants and fun hoodies and coats. Here's Demetrius. He's in a fun little sweatshirt. Some of the actual images of clothing are up on the wall there. Tamara, after we discover she's a woman, will be in a gold outfit. Very sexy. She'll be very sexy in the beginning, then she'll slowly move into an elegant queen. When she goes hunting, we're going to put you all in red. And very impractical hunting. And then at the banquet at the end, when you meet your son, you'll be in a lovely long white gown. And then we'll see how much blood we get on you.
Yeah, if anybody ever shows up in white, be
prepared. Blood's
it's like a John Woo film. I've never seen John Woo films. Had a whole sequence where it happens in a hospital and it's filled with nurses and doctors all dressed in white.
And then we're going to move on to Chiron as Wraith. And as Wraith, I'm going to give you a phallic cock tongue. And bondage-y type straps. Dave referenced him as kind of like raven-like. So we'll also give you raven-like wings and feathers. Then, for Demetrius as murder, having weapons attached to your hands. I'm also going to go with more of a Grim Reaper type hood attached to a very ripped up sweatshirt. But we'll see, like you and Chiron will see lots of skin at this point. You'll be splattered in blood. You'll be murdered in these outfits. And then Tamara as revenge will come out in a horned thing with a very spiky cape. Her cape will be drenched in blood and splattered blood upwards. So this scene will be very black and red. The blood will all be red, so pots of red. And that's kind of the feel. We really get the feel of the like murder, the thriller murder kind of in these, our revenge, rape, and murder. It's right there. Do you guys have any questions?
And, you know, don't have Andy and Nathan here, but I could just talk very briefly. Nathan, Wade, and I have been talking for quite a while about kind of music and sound choices, and he really kind of went full into the kind of feel of grindhouse film and also 70s movies and stuff, so he has a very eclectic, which is the way he's a very eclectic designer, which I really love. And so we have lots of fun musical motifs that are coming up. And an example of like with Andy, the lighting designer, one of the things where we just ended with kind of a revenge, rape, and murder is this kind of bizarre, surreal little scene where these three guys, where Tamara and her two sons show up in these wacky costumes. And, you know, they think Titus is crazy. Everyone thinks Titus is nuts. So they put on basically a little show of their own. So Andy's going to rig up. They're going to come in kind of with their own equipment. So they're going to come in with their own lighting source and their own little kind of Mr. Microphones, possibly, that can distort their voices a little bit. And they're literally going to put on a little play within a play for Titus's benefit. And so it turns into this whole kind of macabre little play that they're doing for him because they think he's insane anyway, and they're hoping to kind of push him over the edge with their little production. And then, of course, Titus is the one who's, we the audience know, has the upper hand, and he actually gets Chiron and Demetrius where he wants and dispatches them after a long, delicious speech. And Andy is also, we've been talking about... there will be, you know, we're working on having a kind of hazy look to it, so having some haze in the theater, you know, to kind of give us that sense of atmosphere. And I've always been a big fan of being able to see the light source beams kind of cutting through haze is always kind of really evocative for me. So And having the thing that I'm also very excited about with our design team is that this is not the first time I've worked with them. I've worked with them all, some of them many, many times. We truly have turned into a wonderfully collaborative team, and we've been talking for months now about this stuff already. And then, you know, when we get into tech is when we get to play with all these wonderful colors and forms and moods that we'll be able to create technically. So it's a real exciting collaboration with the designers, and then also just that you guys know all of the designers in our show are extremely approachable. You can really talk to them, you can ask them questions. They're very, very collaborative in that way, which is also something that I really, really treasure. And then we also, you know, just to say, you know, like with Lou, our stage manager, I've worked with her before. And I've worked with so many of you before. So there's something about this show that always, you know, when I see all of these colleagues and friends of mine who I've worked with so many times before, it just makes it really, really wonderful to get together and work on what is really a tough piece. It really is. But I've worked with so many of you guys that I know that the work we'll get out of each other will be really, really stellar. And that we're all supportive and kind of, because we're going to need some support to get through this. But, you know, it is the holidays. another resource I want to, I encourage you all to use Lenore as much as you can. Lenore Bensinger, our dramaturg, she's got an amazing mind. I'm serious. The way that it connects to so many different things, she's really wonderful to talk to. And I know you put together some packets, and you want to talk about that real quickly.
This is just the beginning, and there's a terrific essay and a link to YouTube about violence in the lesbian time, which really supports all the design work. We've seen people dressing for it, people enjoying it, it being part of the public life in Elizabethan England. And so between the essay that's in there and that link, and I will every day be adding all kinds of essays that you can enjoy, and images, and there's my email and phone.
And Lenore and I had talked a lot about, because she and I have already had some really great discussions about the play and about a lot of different contexts in which the story can be consumed. And she was asking, you know, what would be most helpful for you guys? And I didn't think necessarily a packet on kind of the mores and the traditions of Roman life. I don't know that that really has a whole lot of bearing on this play, because this isn't a play that's based on something from Plutarch. You know, it's not like you can look at, like if you were doing Julius Caesar, I think that something like that would be extremely beneficial. But there's something about the milieu in which this story was created by Shakespeare that I think is very telling and helpful to us. Is that, I mean, I'm really drawn to this idea that people on their way to the theater to see this play in Shakespeare's time might have walked by a public execution. You know, they might have just watched some guy get hanged and eviscerated, and then, well, I'm going to go to the theater now. And that was kind of everyday life. You know, the city of London was teeming with people, with smelly, just, you know, and they would get out into the suburbs to get away from all that and go to the theater. Unless, of course, the plague was raging, and then they'd close all the theaters down. But they would leave the churches open. Well, I thought that was kind of fun. Because, of course, you can only catch disease in the theater, not the church. So anyway, a lot of the material here is really about, I think, just grist for the mill. So, you know, read it, you know, and think about it. But I think that, you know, where we live as a society with the violence that is in our film, on television, real and not real, I think is something that this story kind of exists in that world. And there's something about watching screen violence which is different from watching stage violence, which I find very interesting. To Artaud in his Theater of Cruelty, he talks about how film creates a kind of, it's a machine. So film creates a kind of mechanized filter in which it kind of protects us. So we can watch film, but when you're in the theater space with a person doing something terrible to another person, in some regards, as an audience member, we feel more complicit in that action because we're in person watching it happen in real time. So film, there's always that little thing of like, they filmed that 2 years ago, you know. So there's always something about film that even though the violence can be extremely more graphic, certainly than what we will be able to accomplish on stage, there's something about it happening in real time in front of you that gives it more oomph. And I think that that's an area that we're going to live as well. And I think that this play calls for going after that, is that you have to serve this up. This play goes to some violent places, and it goes to some absurdly funny places. And I think you have to go to both those places to really do this story justice. And I think I like to, as a director, I like to meet the story where it's at and kind of go from there. Instead of trying to, I don't know. I just like to see what's in there, what Shakespeare gives us, and find out why it's there. I'll just give you a beautiful example. I've struggled with this huge, long, lushly poetic speech that Marcus has right after he finds Lavinia with her hands cut off, her tongue cut out. She's covered in blood. She's horrific. And Marcus has this big, long speech. And some of the language is gorgeous. And he's basically describing to us what we see. So you sit there and you go, if this was a movie, you wouldn't have all that, you know? So why does Shakespeare put that there? Here's my kind of idea behind why he puts that there, and this is why he's always much smarter than I am. Even when he was a young playwright where people say, oh, this is crap, he was still better than everyone else. You read Duke of Malta. Titus Andronicus is better written, you know, and I know Christopher Marlowe, he was the penultimate, you know? So anyway, we the audience see this horrific image of a young lady, young, beautiful, young, sweet person who has been completely ravaged and mutilated. How do we survive that as an audience member? How do we survive that and get back into the story? Well, enter Marcus, who brings us back to the story. He has this beautiful speech. He lays out to us through metaphor and poetic language what it is we see. In reality, of course, we see this bleeding, mutilated woman. But somehow, and this is where, you know, this is what the fun of rehearsal is. We'll figure all that out. Is somehow that language brings us back to the story. And I think Shakespeare always does that. You know, when we have these acts of, I mean, after Titus gets his hand cut off, you know, it's, and we see that on stage, you're like going, you know, oh my God, how do we recover from that? And then, of course, we have this beautiful scene between Titus and Lavinia in which they kind of come to this weird understanding of one another. I've lost my hand. You've lost your hands. I love you. You know? And so I think that kind of the way that the violence is tempered with other things, you know, whether it's humanity, whether it's love, whether it's humor, I think is also part of the wonderful texture of this story. And it's just going to be so much fun to delve into it, and fun. I think the play is fun. I remember when I'll go all the way back to when I first started blathering, when I first saw it as an audience member, how much fun it was to watch, and how I loved the experience. It was an experience. It was a spectacle, and I think that's also this idea of kind of a trailer in the front, you know, that kind of creates like an event. It's a spectacle and an event that we're all going to see together, and yes, enjoy.
Okay. Anything else? I think that's it. Yeah.
Dave, can you talk a little bit about the technical aspects of the violence? Since we don't have Julian here.
Yeah. We've already started. We've had both Adam and Matt do masks of their faces. They got to sit, you know, in a Julia Griffin's house with a big bunch of goo on their face and have plaster cast made of their faces so that when they get their heads chopped off, their heads will look real. That's exciting to me. We have a specially designed prosthetic hand for Titus, which will actually be my hand.
Wow.
We have Marley and Julia will be working together on creating some as realistic as possible prosthetics that, you know, we can pass off as, you know, as real. And I think that's part of the fun. I love that. I love seeing that stuff on stage. I love stage blood. And we will have, you know, there will be a combination of blood that can be consumed, you know, that can come out of your mouth and all that, and then blood that will be the combination. I know we've talked about there's some paint that can go on some costumes that still looks kind of wet and gelatinous, you know, which is also a way to kind of handle that. Julia is also a whiz at creating what she calls apparatuses. So we will have various apparatuses for you know, I gleefully call arterial spray. an example is when Titus cuts Chiron and Demetrius' throats, that we're looking at ways of having, because Lavinia collects the blood in a basin, you know, so we have to have blood flowing in which can be caught into a basin. So we'll have, they'll be part of their costumes, have straps and things, so they'll have some sort of colostomy bag filled with blood rigged up, and they just let a little valve go, and blood, you know, spurts and drips and pours and all that good stuff. He says a huge grin. And we will also have an example of weaponry, like when Titus cuts their throats, most likely it'll be rigged up through a knife, so that that Andy will control the spurt from the knife, so that if he cuts like that, the knife squirts out of the blood squirts out of the knife, you know, but it looks like it's very effective. And Julia sent me a little video of one shot she did. The guy used, just had his thumb, looked like he cut his throat with his thumb. It's awesome. And of course, you know, part of, and this will be Lou and Emma's nightmare in some regards, is the gore also creates collateral damage called mess. And this show, you know, this show is going to be a messy show. You know, it's going to be sticky, it's going to be messy. And we're, I'm sure we'll talk about this further, we're already in the planning design of this whole production has been cleanup. Cleanup is a big part of what we have to plan on, you know, and there's Lou discovered a shower in Seattle Center, there's going to be a kind of kiddie pools in the back and all kinds of the logistics, you know, it's I have the easy job of like going, you know, I'd love to see spurting blood everywhere, blood all over the place. And then there's the technical side of it is like, well, A, how do we clean it up? B, where do we get, you know, blah blah blah. So there's a lot of moving parts of this production when it comes to the violence and the gore. I wanted to go full bore into the gore, because I have to say the last few productions, I've seen Titus many times, and I keep going back to that very first production I saw, which just was a blood fest. And granted, they were outdoors, so they could squirt blood everywhere, and no one had to. They just had to put some dirt over it, you know. But I've also seen it done highly abstracted, and I've seen it done in a way that's kind of commented on, and I personally, just as an audience member, I always feel that the theatricality of the violence in this show is part of its appeal. And so I didn't want to do anything that abstracted it or commented on it in any way. I wanted to find a way to theatrically embrace it and kind of make it part of the entertainment. And I think by doing that, you can also, what you have to temper that with is all of the other elements to the story that aren't that. And that is totally what my goal is. I want to go wholeheartedly into the humor where it shows up, but I never want to verge into camp. I don't want to comment on the humor in a way that kind of sends it up in any way. I think in some regards, Shakespeare is inserting humor for very sometimes absurd, strange reasons, and I think that's the fun of rehearsal, is figuring out what that is. And what it does to the story, does it give us, the audience, a moment to breathe? You know, does it give us, he gives us a horrific reaction, a horrific thing, and then we kind of, then we're able to let go of that? Or does it help build tension? I mean, these are the ideas that keep bubbling up for me. And so I think I answered that, the violent technical side. And we're also going to have, I can't remember what day it is, but we're going to have a blood workshop.
And this weekend.
This weekend.
It's this weekend. It's Saturday or Sunday.
And Julia will come and she's going to share some of her ideas and also just give everybody, how many people here have worked with stage blood before? Oh, that is awesome. Well, for, you know, it's always great to be reminded of how sticky and gross it is, and you know, but also how much fun it is. I remember doing Julius Caesar, I got to play, who was it I played? Metellus Cimber. And I always remember we always dive for Julius Caesar to get that big blood pack. You know? That's what I always, that's what I look for. It's like a big juicy kidney that you can kind of. We shouldn't pull that kidney. Excellent, everybody.